Yes, hello. We are on a new program on Karchi Mahalle today in English again. Thank you for being us tonight. We have a very important and valuable guest tonight. And we're going to talk about the events in we started in Minneapolis and just spread all over the cities in the U.S. And tonight we are together with Daniel Todd. Hello, Daniel. Thank you for being us tonight. Daniel Todd is just a professor of philosophy and a lecturer in George Washington University. And he is a filmmaker and he just shots lots of documentaries. And also he's a student of Alan Badiou. So let's start with our talk tonight. I want you, Daniel, ask you to your remarks. In fact, we just started from the recording. It was great. Because you were talking about this events ignited by a racial segregation. This is about it's at least its start, its commencement is something about this. But it has got many more aspects, and especially class aspects. And according to your view and according to your point of view, how can we explain this uprising and revolt after the death of, after the murder of George Floyd?
So thank you, Mark, again for having me. You know, the riot has emerged really within the last 40 or 50 years since about the late 60s as one of the primary modes of struggle. And so I take the view that the riot is not reducible to a sort of anarchist logic, which is not, in other words, I don't view riotous activity as somehow counterproductive to a wider repertoire of struggles. So it's actually, if we look at the history of capitalism in what people call late capitalism or financial capitalism, one of the subject positions which has been the most dynamic is what is called a surplus population. And in the United States, it takes different forms in China, throughout South America, in Europe. But in the United States, the surplus population, the lumpen proletariat, or people excluded from the wage, this is racialized. And so their exclusion is on the basis of a longstanding history of capitalist exploitation. And so the fact that George Floyd and his murder has been elevated to this point, aside from all of the specificity of the demands of protesters around the reform of policing. One thing that's very notable here is we're in what Badiou would call a pre-political sequence, which is to say, this is not an event in a formal sense. This is something which is developing the grounds for a complete reorganization of subjectivity. And this is something that I've, in my own research, my own work on popular struggle, I think this is the most important thing about riots, which is, you know, like you said about Gezi, your experiences in the Gezi occupation, it's striking that in these moments, all of the dominant ideological frameworks no longer are legible. They're no longer coherent on their own terms. So the riot presents a collapse of legibility of struggle. Everything we thought that we knew is somehow thrown out the window. We are forced into a sort of experimental ground and we are set off, we are set adrift in some way. And so we're discovering something in the practical mode of struggle itself. So we become sort of agents along with the rioters, and they become the kind of the phalanx, the vanguard of this discovery. So, you know, I've been very interested in the way that philosophy especially Marxist philosophy, has sought to analyze these protests. I think it's clear that the George Floyd uprising of 2020, whatever its formal name will be, the 2020 uprising, we're not sure. It's very clear that one should analyze it from the standpoint that we analyze the last significant sequence of protests, which really started, some say, in 2006 in the banlieue of outside of Paris. Others say it really started in 2011, and then most seismically, it led to the Arab Spring. This sequence, which then culminated in the occupation movements and the movement of the squares and the assemblies, I think it's a rebirth in a certain sense of that form of antagonism. And the riot is at the center of that form of antagonism. And this to me is of extreme interest, you know, for so many reasons. I'll stop there. I'm sure you have thoughts now.
Okay, so do you think that you are in a kind of event in the Alain Badiou definition?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think that if you read Badiou closely, one can see the temptation. There's a kind of romantic temptation to read Badiou as suggesting that a sort of surprise, transcendental event, which magically appears in our world like this event, like the George Floyd uprisings, one can assume that, oh, it must be some laws of history which are organizing this. It must be something which is beyond our reason. There must be some external logic to it. This is actually not what Badiou means by events, because you also have the subject, which is a part of the event. The event is not some magical thing from outside. If you read Badiou's writings on riots, which he's written a whole book on riots, and actually has been very interested in riots since May 68, you'll find that he always says that a riot itself does not present an event. A riot presents what he calls a pre-political process. So a couple important points. One, we are talking about the condition of politics. We're not talking about art or science, and we're talking about a local emergence of a procedure, of a process. So for Badiou, politics starts a sequence. And why the riot is important for Badiou, but I think for all of us, is precisely in the sense that it does not present a subject immediately, but it presents the possibility of the organization of new subjectivities, you see? So yeah. What it does, and I think this evokes your experience in Gezi Park, is that it invites us to think of a way to subtract ourselves from the dominant way of thinking about politics, and it invites us to look elsewhere, to find a new logic, to find a new framework. For Badiou, that framework must be outside of the state. Not in an anarchist sense, outside of the state, but the organization of political subjectivity cannot spend all of its time within a kind of mimetic battle of the state. So the riot has to get beyond the riot. There has to be a displacement of the riot. The riot is not an end in itself. There must come a point where it makes a connection to a new representation, but its representation cannot be reduced to a contestation of power with the state. I think that's very important, and you see this in the philosophy of, or in the anthropological work of Sylvain Lazarus, which is, he's not thinking of a subjectivity which is subjected to power. He's thinking that a subjectivity that's most interesting is one that has formulated a new form of thinking outside of the matrices of power, so to speak. So what a riot allows is a subtraction and a new site of experimentation. It should not be fetishized as something grand or something great in and of itself. It's merely a signal of the formation of something new.
Yeah. It changes the landscape and it gives way to new subjectivities, really.
Yes.
And it just enlarges the hopes of the proletariat and the working classes and the subaltern classes. But as you have reminded, there is a sequence which started in, let's say, 2011 with the Arab Spring, and it just Athens and Spain and Istanbul, and last year in Chile and in Lebanon, there were just these kind of riots. But in Turkey, for example, we're just discussing about the event in the same approach, with the same approach as yours, because there's a lack of subjectivity. There's a possibility these all riots, as you said, just hires the possibility of a new subjectivity, of a new situation. But since we cannot avoid from this lack of subjectivity of creating a new actor, new political actor, which just combines all these possibilities to a new subjectivity, then we just see the states which came back with a more powerful repression, just as we are experiencing in Turkey. And so can you see a signal when you look at this uprising in America, in the US, which can escape from this, let's say, risk or trap? So there's a dancing of the conflicts, all kinds of conflicts with the state and with this dominant class and the subaltern classes, this racial aspect, there's a working class aspect. But as I said, after this riot, can we have a new opportunity to create a new actor? I'm asking also this about the situation, about this the position of the Democratic Socialists in the Democratic Party after the Sanders campaign. So what can we predict about this situation? Because this is very strange. This is very also interesting for us, because the U.S. is the center of the imperialist world system. And now it looks like it is becoming like the weakest chain, the weakest point of the chain. So how can we look at these controversial aspects of this riot?
Well, I think if you look at the work of Guy Debord, the situationist thinker, up to the work of someone like Joshua Clover in his latest book, Riot, Strike, Riot, the modality of the riot, especially surplus riots, which are dealing with populations, which are led by populations undergoing lumpen proletarianization or undergoing complete exclusion from the wage. One of the things that's very interesting about these moments, structurally, like the background for their emergence, for the emergence of the riot, is that they are linked to crisis within capitalism. And so we've just got over the 4 months of lockdown, quarantine, over the COVID crisis, and we've had a kind of whiplash, an inability to stabilize our political sense. So there was a certain universal idea that, even from a psychoanalytic standpoint, there's a certain repression that came with this period of time. So the event which triggered all of this, the George Floyd murder, if you look at the public opinion polling, and as a Marxist, I'm not somebody who considers public opinion polling to be like the empirical guidepost of my politics. But if you look at it, one will see that there is a sort of, even from a liberal perspective, which I don't necessarily endorse, there is a kind of general consensus in which the U.S. population is in support of these uprisings. Even some of the violent aspects, you see some support for that. So that goes to show that there is a type of prior sets of oppression in the United States, which were unheard, which were unsaid, and which it needed one spark to ignite. So I find, like, you know, if you look at a philosopher like Jean-Paul Sartre, in his Marxist turn, after his existentialist days, where he writes in the Critique of Dialectical Reason, a very interesting idea, which is very much linked to this uprising, which is that what is novel about politics are brief moments where oppressed and dominated groups emerge and form a kind of outlaw solidarity. They perform what he calls an oath in their revolt. So they revolt, and in the process of that revolt, they form a new sort of alternative social contract. And that social contract dissipates. It has a limited lifespan. And this is actually why Badiou will promote the sort of virtue of fidelity as his primary idea. So it is in these brief moments of surprising solidarity through revolt that a kind of new human, a new ethics can emerge. And so we can re-import the very controversial idea of a Marxist humanism by locating it within revolts, if that makes sense. I like that idea. I also think, to your point about the last series of uprisings in Gezi Park, Occupy Wall Street, and these ones, most of the commentators agree that the movements were bought out, that basically they made a pivot to elite forms of politics. You know, clearly you have, for example, the surprising fact that Elizabeth Warren in the United States was elevated as a kind of spokesperson at the end of that sequence. And then you look at her politics and you see a very, very strange disconnect. So there was a kind of, not to mention everything that happened in Greece with Syriza and all of those betrayals. So there was a certain sense in some critiques from groups like Tikkun and the Invisible Committee and sort of far left groups, they have critiqued the format of the occupation movements when they reach the assembly state. So one can therefore cast some doubt on the current movement around its trajectory. In other words, the fact that the riot is illegible, it's in constant flux, it's in constant movement, the fact that it has not reached a point of saturation, I think is good. I think the fact that once you reach the assembly and you have a kind of alternative direct democracy take place, like we had in Zuccotti Park with Occupy Wall Street.
Soviets.
Yeah. Once you have this, let's call it the direct democracy incursion, this is the point at which all of that, what Sartre talked about, the new humanity, what he actually called an apocalypse. That was his definition, that you would call it an event. But once you have that energy, it somehow saturates it. So it therefore becomes a bit of a problem. So it's almost as if democracy or the democratization of the movement presents a kind of a brick wall to its potential. And I would refer to that through the philosophical idea of representation. So there is suffering, there are demands. Right now, the demands are end racism, you know, abolish the police, right? They are very large demands. What assembly does is it concretizes those demands and it kind of localizes them. But here you have the reintroduction of a statist from a politics. So again, to go back to the Lazarus Adieu idea, what's novel about these moments is that they remain non-statist. And this is the very challenging thesis that they give to us. It's unclear how exactly a protest movement can remain in the space of a non-statist orientation. I mean, if you read the latest manifesto from the French kind of far-left group, Tikkun, I don't know if you read their work. It's called Now. It's a very good manifesto. They make a similar claim, which is one must avoid what they call the constitutive itch of the riot, which is all of the grievances, all of the demands, one must avoid formalizing them as demands. In other words, there's a kind of argument, which I find compelling, that the more the movement stays within the space of non-representation or the space of irrepresentability, it's almost as if the logic is that this will allow the movement to project a different, more novel contestation, you see. So this is the kind of things that I find very interesting right now.
Really, this is a very, really difficult point, because direct democracy and representation may also be taken as disadvantages of these kind of movements, because I think also these kind of thoughts can produce big gaps between the riot and just interpret itself as a kind of political as a political subject.
This is a very good point. I think that Thierry Communiste and other groups have pointed to the danger that we see in China. I mean, China has more riots than any other place, and the strike, which is a form of protest around the wage, increase of the wage, versus the riot, which I understand the riot to be a struggle around commodification and the circulation of commodities. So when you see looting and you see that kind of violence to commercial property, I really take the idea that what a riot presents is a collapse of the dialectic between the state and the economy. And what a riot, especially a racialized surplus riot, does is it invites the state and its repressive apparatus into visibility. So it reveals the excessive repression of the state, which is otherwise hidden. And I'm sure you've seen this in Turkey. The militarization can be revealed like this. So from a representational standpoint, a liberal will say, we must seize this excess of the state and show the voters in the democracy how bad it is. Whereas the non-representational view will make the argument that we must displace the riot into the sphere of production. In other words, what has been unable to come out of Occupy, what Syriza was unable to do, was not to go from the insurrection to electoral power. And even with Occupy Wall Street in the US, that's kind of what happened with Bernie Sanders. It was from this kind of outside group where we elect a politician that represents us. Rather, what if we thought the movement from insurrectionary street protest to the sphere of labor? I think that's been that has not yet happened. And this is something which is very significant. In other words, to displace the logic of the demands onto the social reproductive wage relation itself. Because underneath all of these demands for reform of police is the fact that the black population in the US, so many of them, are subjected to surplus life, to lumpen proletarian, is it to formal exclusion from, I mean, in my neighborhood, I have people in the what's called the black market. Vast majority are young men. they have no job prospects, they have no educational prospects, their quality of life is deteriorated, their lifespan, how long they live, is deteriorated. I mean, with the opioid epidemic after the 2008 economic crash, you also see the same phenomenon in rural white populations. Their lifespan is decreasing. So these are riots about the crisis of capitalism, about the crisis of the inability of capitalism to reproduce itself, right? So therefore, their successful linkage, because again, for Baju, the riot cannot be a fetish. We cannot fetish the riot in and of itself. It must be seen as a means to a beyond. And that beyond must be to the nexus of the wage capital machine as such. This is my view. I don't know if you agree with that, but this is how I don't know the answer on how to do that, but this is how I believe the movement needs to go. It should not go to a leader on high. All of the left populist stuff with Bernie Sanders showed that the liberal political machine of the capitalist class will always seek to disarm popular representation. So I think representation vis-a-vis leaders is not what's necessary at this moment, if we learn anything from the prior series.
Yeah, I think just maybe this is a very challenging question, of course, because I don't think that any socialist all around the world has got a very concrete answer for these kind of questions, because this is the main point that we are stuck at, I think, because all these riots, we know, just capitalism, just it creates crisis all the time, and it just excludes a huge portion of the society, and it creates a big anger. And we have some kind of experience all about these kind of topics, but we don't know really. I think we couldn't find a possible way to just create a political actor and at the same time to create our direct democracy councils and to create a dialectic relation between two of these points. I think both of them are very important. I think we cannot give up of any one of it, but it must be in a balance. And if we can't create this balance, and we are going to experience more betrayals like Syriza's case, and also like we can also find anything after all these kind of riots if we cannot create a kind of representative apparatus. Because in the Gezi days, the most popular motto in Turkey was just nothing will be the same after that. Mm. In one aspect, it's correct because everything became worse because we cannot create a kind of apparatus to just continue the moment, and all the different fractions of the dominant classes get together, because really it was a very critical juncture between 2013 and 2015 in Turkey. And the political pact between the Kurdish movement and the socialists got a really big momentum, and we got a very hard backlash, and we just live in this kind of fascistic order in the last 2 or 3 years. And I think this shows that the real power that we had. But I think what Rosa Luxemburg said also true, this fascism is a kind of punishment of an unfailed revolution also. So I think there is a very complicated and challenging question that we need to find an answer for that. So what do you think about the perspective of this riot and what's going on these days, especially on this particular moment? And what is your prediction about its next moment, next phase?
Well, I don't want to be the predicting type. I try to avoid such urges. I will say it's novel. I mean, it's in every state in the union, all 50 states. You know, we haven't really seen the sustained level of energy for a while. So it's promising. One observation that's important, and I'm sure you've experienced this, is we are experiencing various modalities of division, which are necessary. However, it will be very interesting to track the way that they proceed. And by that, I mean, right now, the sort of liberal bourgeoisie is seeking to identify a split within the movement between what we might call a communicative side, a side which is on the nonviolent, you know, let us present these demands to a population for the purpose of convincing them to get Donald Trump out of the office, like this kind of liberal side of the riot, versus a more practical surplus-driven side, which is more dynamic, because it's that side of the riot which possesses the possibility. And I think if you look at Badiou's writing on uprisings, he makes a very nice point, which is, in reality, what is interesting about a moment like this is the possible subjective formation, which is formally prohibited in the prior world. So if a riot opens up a new world, a new vista, what it allows is the creation of points between subjectivities which were not supposed to unite with each other. So yes. In 68, it was workers and students. But if you follow what they were able to do, you know, you had figures coming in and out of factories, you had factory workers in the streets, you had all of this kind of act. So I think the question is, what are these outlaw solidarities and how are they going to sustain the movement going forward? So far, I think one important thing it has done is that it has shown that the discourse on racial injustice from the liberal side of view of the aisle really is a flat, inefficacious discourse. It's really revealed that. And it has shown that a more practical approach, a more militant approach, is of the order of what's necessary. And so I'm not exactly sure how these solidarities will emerge, but the only way we can know is if the energy is sustained and that it proceeds in the way that it is proceeding. So in some sense, I don't want to touch it, because it is moving at a speed which is, like I said before, irrepresentable. And that's exactly how it should be.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, and just thank you very much for your nice and very valuable comments, Daniel. And I'm going to just finish with one question. That's, why do you prefer the term surplus instead of precariat? For example, what is your attitude towards this?
Yeah, I mean, the precariat is a category of class analysis which refers to those that have a linkage to the wage. Surplus is very different. A surplus population tends to be an urban lumpen proletariat excluded from the wage relation. Mm-hmm. They are on the margins of criminality. They have a hostile orientation to the state. And this is why they become the agent of these riots, because they live an antagonistic orientation to the state on a daily basis. A precariat is a downwardly mobile petty bourgeois figure. It's very different. Some people, obviously, I mean, maybe the linkage we could think about would be between precariat and surplus. Obviously, that linkage is happening right now in the riots, no doubt. But I think the novel point about the practical militant side of the riots is that it is being led primarily by surplus populations, excluded from the wage, on the margins of criminality, and so on. And that is a feature of riots ever since the late 60s to the present, of race riots, you see. So I think that's the clarification I would offer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You gave great points. Thank you very much, Daniel.
My pleasure.
It was a great pleasure to host you tonight on this Karşı Mahalle screen. Have a good luck in this uprising.
Solidarity, my friend. All the best.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Thank you.